Thanks for joining us this morning after Thanksgiving. Hope you had a great holiday. I'm Sheila Cast. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. Few lines are as formidable as the line between a university and the people who live near it, sometimes a physical wall, often impenetrable attitudes. In Baltimore, tensions between some elite universities and the people who live nearby have lingered for generations. Morgan State University is taking a different approach, working with neighboring businesses and residents in Northeast to create a partnership for improving the quality of life in Northeast Baltimore. The initiative is called the Morgan Community Mile, but it's already burst beyond a mile radius to include most of the city's Northeast quadrant. Joining me now to discuss the Morgan Community Mile is Mary Ann Alabanza Akers, Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at Morgan State University. Dean Akers, welcome to the show.
Thank you for asking me to be here.
Also with us is Catherine Evans, Secretary of NECO, the Northeast Community Organization. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks for inviting us.
Dean Akers, the Morgan Community Mile is in its initial stages of development. What can you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, our president, Dr. David Wilson, when he came, he wanted to make a difference in the communities around Morgan. And so this was actually his idea to start an initiative, a university community-based initiative called the Morgan Community Mile. So initially he thought, you know, let's have 1 mile radius where Morgan State was the center. But when we looked at the data and looked at different neighborhoods and what the city looks at in terms of the statistics, we had to go beyond the mile.
So you're actually embracing, I think, 9 neighborhoods.
Actually, it's 9 community statistical areas with 49 different neighborhoods.
49 different neighborhoods.
Yes.
But what is it going to be?
So right now we have, I would say, topical areas, 7 topical areas that the community identified with us. These are public safety, healthy families, workforce and economic development, education and youth development, sustainable environment, livable, viable neighborhoods, and culture, art, recreation, and entertainment.
I went to the goals and objectives session last week, and I heard one person pose the question, what does the community need to do? Catherine Evans, you've been involved in this process since the talks began. Does the community have specific responsibilities to make this work?
Well, the community is very involved in its own community associations and umbrella organizations. But this is an opportunity to think together and envision what the future can be for us all when we work together. And I think we're all excited about that.
Let me back up a minute to set the groundwork. Are there tensions between Morgan and its neighbors, Morgan State and its neighbors?
Just like any town gown situation, there is always. It's basically about parking. Students parking in the local roads and things like that. But fortunately, President Wilson has solicited funds from the state to build the North Parking Garage.
I just want to mention that, you know, it's always a good thing to have an historical perspective. And Morgan moved to Northeast Baltimore in 1917. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms by the community at that point. And so there's a long history of separation between the communities, which has experienced a gradual softening. For example, there's a community called Morgan Park. Oh, it's a residential community adjacent to the campus. The reason that Morgan Park was built was because the faculty of Morgan State University could not live in the neighborhoods that surrounded the campus.
Could not.
Originally.
Could not because right. of covenants, because of
Segregation. Mm-hmm. Whether it was directly through explicit covenants or not. So We've come a long way since that time of 95 years ago. But this step of working together in planning, as I said, is really a fresh look at the relationship.
On WYPR, this is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Catherine Evans, Secretary of NECO, the Northeast Community Organization, and Marianne Akers, Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at Morgan State. We're talking about the Morgan Community Mile.
At the November 14th meeting about the Morgan Community Mile, I talked to Randolph Jews. He's an alumnus of Morgan State. He's a member of the Hill and Road Improvement Association. He said he's lived near Morgan for more than 30 years, and I asked him about his hopes for the Morgan Community Mile.
I'm hoping that we can use Morgan as an extension to generate some basics in the community. Sense of neighborhood and community needs to be touched, and I think the school's an optimal location for it to radiate from.
Is there one thing that you might look at to say, hey, it's working, or oh, it's not working?
It has to be a reciprocal effort. It can't be something that's generated from the institution and from these meetings if the community doesn't participate. And so to leverage their involvement, I think, would be probably the most prominent factor to indicate how successful it's been.
Dean Akers, when I asked Mr. Jews to give me an example of what leveraging Morgan's involvement could mean, he said, currently fraternities and sororities tutor students in the community, and he'd like to see more of these types of activities. Is student involvement a major component of the Morgan Community Mile?
Students have been involved in the community already, but the difference with the Morgan Community Mile is it's more of a concerted effort, and we will track impact. So we'd like to make sure that we're not just doing things for the sake of doing things, that we're able to document the impact of what we do. And one very important thing to remember is that we are going to be very strategic. Morgan State cannot be everything to everyone. So that's why these meetings are very critical. Yes, the planning meetings, very critical for us to really focus on the things that we can do well together with the community.
Dean Akers, I heard President Wilson say at the State of Black Baltimore event that it's been common in some cities, or I don't know that he said common, but it has been the case that some white academic institutions, he mentioned Harvard and Rutgers in particular, in their cities, have seen themselves as the drivers for community development, for improving the community. And he said it hasn't really been true for historically black institutions. Is Morgan doing something different here? Is it taking a risk?
We are doing something different. And yes, he's absolutely right that it's usually the white institutions who are engaged in these community initiatives. Morgan, when we did an analysis of where our students and faculty and staff live, we found out that many of them live within our Morgan Mile boundaries. You know, it's about time that We engage those who actually live, work, play, and worship within those boundaries.
So this planning process and this community mile could mean something for businesses in the area.
Absolutely. And Morgan has made a decision to acquire a large piece of property on the other side of Hill and Road, Pering Parkway, which is a portion of what's known as the Northwood Plaza. Which is will be a parcel for their business school and other to be determined academic buildings, and that is going to make a huge difference in the condition of that shopping center.
Catherine, let me draw on your perspective with involvement in the umbrella organizations and other civic groups. What's your sense overall in the city of engagement between colleges and universities and their neighbors? Do you have a sense?
Well, in North Baltimore, we're blessed to have several institutions of higher learning. And in the last 10 years or so, I think there's been a pretty concerted effort on the parts of several of them to work with the communities. I know one thing that the community would really relish would be the possibility for Morgan to grow its continuing studies programs, which would bring the community onto campus. You know, I think this is a process of taking ownership of our common space and not defining it as containing impermeable boundaries, but as something that we are in it together on.
Thank you both for walking us through this.
Thank you.
Catherine Evans is Secretary of NECO, the Northeast Community Organization, and a board member of the Northeast Development Alliance. Marianne Alabanza Akers is Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at Morgan State. We have a link to the Morgan Community Mile on our website, wypr.org. Later in this hour, The Lines Between Us continues when Tom Hall interviews the maker of a film about an effort to interrupt the cycle of street violence. But up next on Maryland Morning, a literary interlude, an Annapolis entrepreneur's memoir of being a kid when the Nazis occupied his homeland. I'm Sheila Cast. It's WYPR on 88.1.
I'm Assistant Producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1 from Hodson Hall on the campus of Johns Hopkins University, I'm Tom Hall, and this is the WYPR Maryland Film Festival Spotlight. Thank you very much. Tonight, a conversation with Steve James. He's the director of The Interrupters, an unstinting look at efforts to end violence in some of Chicago's most troubled neighborhoods. It's Tuesday, November 13th, 2012, and we're here on the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University for a special screening of this acclaimed documentary, which is broadcast on PBS's Frontline and which has received screenings at leading film festivals around the world. The Interrupters has won numerous awards, and it found its way to more than 60 lists of best films of the year in 2011. We are delighted to present it tonight to our audience here at Hopkins and to welcome the filmmaker, Steve James. So it's good to see you, and wonderful to see this beautiful movie. You did a very acclaimed movie in 1994 called Hoop Dreams, and you've returned to that same neck of the woods in some instances to do this movie, The Interrupters. For folks who haven't had a chance to see the movie yet, tell us who The Interrupters are.
Well, the Interrupters are violence interrupters. They work for this organization in Chicago called Ceasefire. They've just changed their name to Cure Violence. But these are basically ex-gang bangers, drug dealers, convicts, sometimes all three, who now work in the very neighborhoods where they once were part of the problem of creating violence to try and stem violence. And so they work for this innovative program, and they're out in the streets, and they're trying to stop it on the front end, as they say, to prevent it from happening or stop retaliations once it's gotten underway.
So the animating guy behind this Ceasefire or Cure Violence is an epidemiologist named Gary Slutkin, and he's approached this as a medical person, as a researcher would approach it, saying that, you know, you've got to sort of stem it at its source. Baltimore and many communities around the country have had long-standing conversations about policing and efforts to, you know, address this kind of problem, community policing versus zero-tolerance policing. I wonder, what is the data about how this particular interventionist approach is working?
Well, in Chicago, they've had some very good success. And by that, I mean that there have been some studies that shown in the neighborhoods where they're active that they've seen a reduction in violence up to, you know, 35% or so, 40% of violent crime. So that, I mean, that adds up. And there's been numerous studies. And then, of course, it's hard to see the other kind of impact. I think one of the things the film is about is not just looking at to what degree they're able to prevent someone from committing an act of violence or retaliation, but the degree to which they're also able to actually interrupt a life, if you will, to intervene in a life and try and turn it in a different direction.
Of course, studies are fungible things. New York Times just did a piece last week about a woman at Northwestern University who's doing a long study, 17 years they've been studying the kinds of folks that you talk about in this movie. And this year, gang violence and gang deaths are up 100% from last year. It's 25% higher overall gang violence last year. So Chicago is still in the news as a place where violence appears to be just out of control.
Absolutely. And yeah, I was telling someone earlier that at the end of October, Chicago passed last year's murder total for all of last year with 2 months to go. There, over 500 murders in the city this year. So yeah, I mean, it's a thing that fluctuates quite a bit. At its height in Chicago back in the late 80s, early 90s, at the height of the crack epidemic, there were over 900 murders a year in the city of Chicago. So overall, the trend has improved, there's no question, but there's still an awful long way to go.
This cycle of violence that, we've all just read about, heard about, thought about, dealt with, is on some level simply an abstraction for people who do not have any daily interaction with people who are living in severe poverty and the kind of despair that you depict in this movie. I wonder, Linda Teplin, the woman I was just talking about who's doing this study over the long period of time in Chicago, she said that what rivets Americans is the unexpected, the Aurora shooting, the Columbine shooting, and the chronic violence, the day-to-day life that these folks have to live in is just not something that's grabbing people's attention. I wonder if, having lived with it for as long as you have and studied it as close as you have, if there were some groundswell of outrage about the chronic violence that went past outrage from the communities themselves, but extended to communities that aren't themselves affected, what do you think would happen? How would that move the ball forward?
First of all, there are a lot of people out there that care deeply about this issue and are working tirelessly day in and day out in a lot of cities to address it. I found that out by doing this film. Found out about it going on in Chicago, but also traveling with the film to other cities and seeing the heroic efforts that people are making. So I think that's the good news. I think the essential thing you're up against, in my view, are two things. One is that many of us, unless we live in those communities, don't feel endangered. And when you don't feel endangered, it's harder to frankly care about it. When things like these Aurora shootings happen, or that's the kind of violence that scares us all, because we can all imagine being in a movie theater and having some crazy nut open fire, and we feel more threatened in a way by the prospect of something like that. Whereas if it happens in a poor neighborhood, you just think, well, I'm just not going to go to those neighborhoods. I never go to those neighborhoods, so why do I have to worry about that? I think the other factor of it is that we have this sense that it is this daily, ongoing violence, and that people must have tried to work on it. There must be people out there that have tried and they haven't succeeded, so what can I do about it? And I think that it's the news media comes in for a hit on this too, because there's a tendency to report these crimes and focus sometimes on the thing that really isn't what it's about. For instance, it seems that a lot of violence in neighborhoods like Inglewood in Chicago, where we were, could be over something as petty as, you looked at my girlfriend wrong, or, I'm in a club and someone's champagne bottle sprayed on me and that got me angry and it ended up in a brawl and then someone got killed. These are not the reasons that people kill each other, but that's what gets reported. And I think we have a tendency to look in the paper and read about an incident and say, oh my God, if people are killing each other over a pair of tennis shoes, over looking at my girlfriend wrong, what can you possibly do with people like that? And I think one of the things that the film tries to make clear, and Amina, I think, makes it crystal clear at one point.
And Amina is one of the
one of the interrupters. When she talks about how if you wake up in the morning and you don't have enough to eat, and you're wearing hand-me-down clothes, and your mother is in a dysfunctional relationship with a man, and maybe that man has abused you in some way, that by the time you get to school, someone bumping into you, that's who's going to get it. And so it's taking a step back and looking at this in a much more holistic way to see that the role that this violence plays.
Speaking of a holistic approach, unemployment is most recently 71% in the neighborhood among the men in the neighborhoods that you're talking about. 59% of women in these neighborhoods. It's unimaginable. So there is this, you know, many layered dimension to this problem: absent parents, no job skills, bad schools, etc. Is interrupters and this program, Ceasefire Cure Violence, is it a triage approach, or are you finding that as they continue, they are coordinating with other agencies, etc., whomever, to fix the broader problem?
Yeah, well, I think Ceasefire, and again, they've changed their name to Cure Bond, so I should probably use that name for as much as possible here. But they tend to focus much more on the violence. That's their focus. And they do have outreach workers, which we didn't profile in the film, that part of the program where they are engaged then with trying to help out in some of these other areas, like with job employment and things like that. But the heart of the program for Cure Violence and Ceasefire is focused on reducing the violence. But one of the things that we discovered, and the theory is there, is that if you reduce the violence, then those other things will be able to be nurtured and happen in a community. And I think there's absolutely some truth to that. On the other hand, we also found in doing this film that they're all kind of interrelated. And the best interrupters, the three we followed, Eddie, Kobe, and Amina, I think you see in the film, they go beyond just dealing with people in terms of trying to stop them from committing a violent act. They get very much engaged in people's lives beyond that, because it's going to take that. Because as Eddie says at one point in the film, if I stop a shooting this week between these gang members, I can say, okay, well, I stopped a shooting. But then if they turn around and kill each other next week, what did I really accomplish? So it takes more than just stopping a violent act. It takes, well, so then what? And you see in this film, in at least two cases, with two of the subjects that they work with, two of the people they work with, Flamo, that Kobe works with, and Little Mikey, that Kobe also works with, you see the power of getting a job in the lives of people who have had violent histories. That the power of getting a job is amazing in terms of being part of what can turn someone around.
How did they find the folks to have this job?
How they find them, you know, Teo Hardeman, who created the Interrupters program within Ceasefire, he finds them in different ways. He finds them by referrals for guys and men and women who are present interrupters.
We should mention that each of the three that you profiled had criminal backgrounds, extensive criminal backgrounds.
Absolutely.
Themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. Extensive criminal backgrounds, yes. So, yeah, I mean, Eddie Bocanegra had done 14 years for murder and was a serious gangbanger. Kobe Williams was a serious gangbanger himself, had done four stints for a variety of crimes, including attempted murder. And Amina Matthews is the daughter of a notorious gang leader, Jeff Fort, one of the most powerful gangsters really in American criminal history, who is in prison now in Colorado, and probably if he lives to be 93, maybe he'll get out. But so, yes. And so, you know, I think Teo finds people coming out of prison. He finds them through word of mouth, through the streets, and through the connections to other interrupters.
Steve James is the director of The Interrupters. If you haven't seen it, get out there and check it out. It's a terrific movie. Steve James, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got links to more information about The Interrupters on our website, wypr.org. Just click on the Maryland Morning link. On 88.1, you've been listening to the WYPR Maryland Film Festival Spotlight. Throughout the year, we'll have more events like this one, in which WYPR collaborates with the Maryland Film Festival to take you behind the scenes with interesting film artists. Stay tuned to Maryland Morning for information about the next events in the Spotlight series. This edition of the Spotlight is also part of our year-long series, The Lines Between Us, which examines inequality in our region, and you hear every Friday here. here on Maryland Morning. And we want to hear from you. How does inequality in the Baltimore region look from where you live? We have a special part of our website called Your Stories, so tell us some. You can leave us a voicemail that we can use on the air or on the web. Call 410-881-3162. That's 410-881-3162. Or go to linesbetweenus.org and leave your story on the Your Stories page. Thanks to Steve James, thanks to Jed Dietz and the staff of the Maryland Film Festival, thanks to Johns Hopkins and to Micah, and thanks to all the nice folks who joined us here at Johns Hopkins University this evening. From Hodson Hall on the campus of Johns Hopkins, in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus, or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.